Everybody ready for a great day? It's going to be great.
Lisa.
Is that good?
Okay. Lisa.
Yeah, I'm ready.
2, 1. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Richie T. Do you have as many plastic grocery bags accumulating as I do? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to talk to one organization about what they're doing to eliminate them altogether. And coming up in your morning buzz, if you have always wanted to change your name, feel like maybe your name doesn't quite suit who you think you are, I'm going to give you some details about how you can do it. That's coming up just 15 minutes away.
Dr. Drew Faust has had a vast and remarkable career. She was the founding dean for the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, and in 2007 became the first female president of the university. As an author historian, she has written 6 books, multiple of which are prize winners, and was elected to the Society of American Historians in 1993. In September of 2018, Dr. Faust was awarded the John W. Kluge Prize for Achievement in the Study of Humanity by the Library of Congress. If that wasn't enough, today she's currently a board member of Goldman Sachs. Dr. Drew Faust has spent her career breaking glass ceilings, especially for women, and we're honored to be speaking with her today about her life path and her experience in these different roles as a woman pioneer. Welcome, Dr. Faust.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And most people know you as Harvard's first woman president, but we know a lot has happened in your life to get you to that point. For you, what were some of those pivotal moments in your early career that led you on this path?
Well, I never expected to be a university administrator. When I finished my PhD in 1975, I entered the classroom and loved being there, and loved the chance to interact with students and to do scholarly work in my field of Southern history and Civil War history. But I was entering the academy at a time when things were really opening up for women in dramatic ways, and there was a lot of effort to bring women into positions of influence and authority in universities. And so I was often asked, did I want to be a dean? Did I want to take on a leadership role? And I always said, no, I wanted to stay in the classroom. And then in 2000 or 1999 and then into 2000 when Neil Rudenstein at Harvard said, why don't you come and start this new piece of Harvard that is emerging from the merger of the old Women's College Radcliffe with Harvard? I kept saying, well, I don't think so. And then he just kept talking to me. And before I knew it, I was picking up and moving from Penn, where I taught for 25 years, and taking on this new role. And to be frank, I loved it. I loved the chance to work together with people to advance a common goal and to think about universities as organizations and institutions of influence in our culture. And so that's what happened.
It's funny to listen to you describe the sort of surprise that you had, or even almost reluctance to that. You know, in moving forward, you know, you're an inspiration to so many women. Who were those women in your life who inspired you, you know, in the direction of your education and career?
Well, I went to women's schools. I went to a girls' school for high school, and I went to Bryn Mawr College for college. And so I saw a lot of powerful women. There was the head of the school, high school I went to, Concord Academy, was this formidable woman named Elizabeth Hall, who seemed undaunted by anything. And so she was a kind of role model. And then when I got to Bryn Mawr, I saw a lot of women who were scholars and PhDs and researchers and leaders in academic fields. And I think that was the most direct inspiration for where I went. And just to name one of these women, a woman named Mary Maples Dunn, who was a history teacher of mine in college, went on to become president of Smith. And then she came to Radcliffe, actually, and was the acting dean before she'd retired from Smith, but was acting dean at the Radcliffe Institute before I arrived. And then she went on to be the head of the American Philosophical Society. So she was a person who also combined family and career in a way that some of the early pioneers of women in academia did not. And so Mary was a particularly wonderful role model for me. And she was a wonderful, wonderful person.
You talk about entering academia, you know, back in the mid to late 70s and to where we are today. I would be curious, what do you think has the biggest accomplishment of, say, the last 40 years? What is that that greatest ceiling that's been broken through? And what are you still surprised that, we're struggling to break through?
Well, the population, the demographics of academia have changed so dramatically in those years, and that includes the welcoming of women, but it also includes a much broader array of groups that had been previously underrepresented significantly in university populations of students and also of faculty and leadership. So we see African Americans, Hispanics, Latinx population, we see Asian Americans, we see undocumented students at Harvard now and elsewhere. We see just such a wide range of talent, which of course makes these institutions so much stronger, because the bigger the pool you have from which to draw, the greater talent you are able to attract. And so I think that's been a revolution. And it's been accompanied with efforts to make higher education affordable, which I think is essential for the kinds of changes that I've described. So those are dramatic shifts in what higher education has represented in this country during the time that I've been involved in it.
Specifically, during your time as president of Harvard, what changes did you see happen for women? And was that something that you set out to do and what you wanted your mark on the university to be?
It certainly was. And we increased the numbers of women in positions of leadership. I was the only woman who was a dean when I arrived. And when we had dean's meetings, it was me and all these men with the university president. And now I think half of the deans are women. So that's a pretty dramatic shift. And four of those are African-American women. So that also is a dramatic shift. So I'm very pleased that all of that's happened. There's just to tell a little story. There's someone that I worked with who'd been at Harvard as an administrator for many, many, many years. And towards the end of my presidency, he said to me, you know, when I used to be in meetings at Harvard, I always knew that if I came into a room and there were a lot of women in the room, this wasn't going to be a significant meeting. He said, now, if there are not a lot of women in the room, I know it's not going to be a significant meeting.
Wow.
So he just described that sort of shift in in how the landscape was configured at the university over those years. That meant a lot to me, actually, when he told me that story.
Wow. We're talking with Dr. Drew Faust, who is the president emerita of Harvard University, among a lot of other things. I hate to put you in that singular box. But I would be curious then, sort of looking forward, what are those things that are on the horizon, or what are those ceilings that are yet to be broken?
Well, one of the, I think, insights that has come into consciousness more forcefully in recent years among academic leaders and throughout universities more generally is that diversity isn't enough. Just changing the demography is not enough. You bring people together, but you have to make sure that everyone can flourish in the environment that you have created. And so we now talk about diversity, inclusion, and belonging. And there's an awful lot of work to be done on the also, still on diversity, the numbers still aren't where they should be, but a lot of work on making sure that when people do get access to institutions of higher education, that they feel fully part of those communities and able to take advantage of all the opportunities that they offer. So that seems to me high on the agenda of where we need to focus in the years to come.
Well, taking a larger look at the impact that you've had, certainly in education, you recently just gave a powerful speech here virtually at BYU about the importance of having humility during the lifelong road of learning. And I'm wondering if you could expand on that, about why you believe that humility is so vital to education.
Well, I began the speech talking about a memory of my very first week in college when our university, or college president, it was Bryn Mawr College, when she addressed us as the kind of capstone event of that beginning week. And she talked about humility and how if you're going to learn anything, you have to recognize that you don't know everything already. And so learning is kind of predicated on this assumption of ignorance and of limits that you currently confront, but that you can break through with the help of education. And so that notion of asking questions and being open and not feeling that you know everything or can tell everybody how they ought to understand the world, but rather work to come to new understandings, that seems to me critical to every element of pursuing education. And I continued by saying something else that this college president said to us, which was, you know, every incident in her life, she asked, what can I learn from this? And this was until presumably her dying day. And that, I think, is another aspect of education, is that we're never done. Yeah. We're never educated. We're always becoming educated. And so that demands a certain humility, too. It's whatever degrees you may have. Don't just rest on them. There's still more to learn.
You know, as we look at sort of your life sketch, the different things that you've entered into and engaged in, then had the opportunity to be able to lead, and then to know and note that now you are a board member at Goldman Sachs, it almost begs a question, like one of these things is not like the other. Like a president of a university is not the same as being a board member at Goldman Sachs. I would be curious, what encouraged you to take that position? And similarly, like academia, that to me seems like a situation where it would be predominantly men.
Well, there are several aspects of the position at Goldman Sachs that attracted me. One is it's a big organization that's very visible and kind of has a target on its back all the time. And that seemed to me similar in some ways to Harvard. It also depends on talent and recruiting talent and nurturing talent. And so I felt that perhaps I could have something to offer in relationship to that. But what I hoped in joining the board was to be able to think with people at Goldman Sachs about the relationship that business can have towards advancing good outcomes for our society and the people in it. And how can business and other sectors of society and the economy work together for some of the social justice goals that I think are so important? And I've been so pleased to be able to work together on a board with CEO David Solomon, who is deeply committed to issues of diversity. His predecessor, Lloyd Blankfein, had been one of the leaders in speaking out about LGBTQ issues. David has made strong commitments to bringing in both women and more diverse populations in terms of underserved groups. And he just announced an initiative involving Black women. So how do we use the resources of the American economy to support these kinds of advancements in our society? And so it's been interesting for me to sit on that board and think about what is the relationship between business, which is such an important part of American life, mm-hmm. and some of the goals that have been central to me throughout my life.
It's interesting that you have all these opportunities moving forward, and it is in the objective then, it seems to me, is to help other people and to lend a helping hand. Has that always been a focus of your life?
I guess so. From the time I was a small child growing up in segregated Virginia in the 1950s and 60s, I always had this powerful sense of what was fair and what wasn't fair. I think maybe some of that came from growing up in a family where I had three brothers and they were all told they could do things that I wasn't allowed to do. And my mother would say, it's a man's world, sweetie, and you need to understand this. It made me furious.
Wow.
And so I think I have just always wanted to say, how can we make things more fair? And that's a form of service, I think, but I think it was motivated by this notion of justice.
It almost seems like sort of a trite mm-hmm. question, but I would be curious. The people that are you know, not lacking, that's not the word I want to use, but that are searching for the motivation that would look at your life and say, well, of course, Dr. Drew Faust can do that. But what possible difference could I sort of make? Speaking to that individual, what sort of advice would you give them?
Everybody can make a difference. I think education is an important part of that. So perhaps the first advice I'd give is pursue your education and see what captures you within it and what direction it might indicate you could follow and achieve some of the goals that are motivating you. So that would be a beginning. But also one of the aspects of my life that has been surprising but foundational is that I never knew what to expect. I never had a plan because for women, when I was growing up, to have said I'd be president of Harvard, yeah. people would have thought you were crazy. Mm-hmm. So you have to be open to doors that may open before you and to understand that you may have opportunities that you haven't predicted or planned for and be aware of looking for those and then seizing them when they come.
Yeah. I would also ask the question, are there things that you know, as you get to do the second part of your life and you're looking at things that you want to accomplish?
It's going to be a long life.
Yeah. are there things that for you are on your horizon where you're...
Yeah, what you're looking forward to.
Yeah.
Well, I've really enjoyed in my post-presidential time, almost 3 years now, returning to the classroom and being together with remarkable Harvard students in seminars where we can talk about a variety of issues and texts and historical happenings. That has been extremely rewarding. And seeing these young people and thinking about what they mean for the future is very gratifying. I'm also working on a book, which is a kind of combination memoir history of growing up in the 50s and 60s. And what motivated me is that I've spent a lot of my scholarly life listening to the voices of people from other times, listening to the voices of women in the Civil War, listening to the voices of those who lost loved ones in the Civil War to write my book about death. And so I have some things I want to say. I want to be a voice that perhaps can help define and interpret and communicate what the 1950s and 60s were like once those of us who lived through them are no longer around to do so. So that's what I hope to be doing now. I think that era has not entirely been understood, and it was a transformative era. It has yielded the kinds of changes and opening up that we were just talking about. And to understand that, I think, is important to understanding how we can continue to become a more just society.
Dr. Drew Faust, the president emerita of Harvard University, the first female president of Harvard, and a well-known author and historian. We would love to extend the invitation that when that book is published to come back on the show and to tell us about that.
Well, thank you so much.
Now, coming up, we're going to find out if single-use plastic bags could soon become a thing of the past, and if you've ever thought of changing your name. Well, today may be the very day that you want to do that. I'll tell you, coming back in your morning buzz, you're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Are you thinking about getting into shape before summer gets here? Well, in 20 minutes, we're going to tell you what you need to know before you start lifting weights. But first, it is time for your morning buzz, a time when I have gathered three news stories that are trending from the internet, and I present them to you. I want to get through these first two pretty quick because, well, this third one is pretty hefty. The first one, Gwen Stefani, new music out today. People are hoping that it is like a Holla Back Girl 2.0, and it is not. It is not as good as Holla Back from Gwen Stefani's past. But she does, in fact, have new music, so if you like the Gwen Stefani, that's out and available and trending online. Also, if you like the High School Musical, specifically if you like the TV show that has been on Disney+, there's new semester, new competition, new drama, and it starts streaming. The season 2 of High School Musical, the musical, that series sets off on May 14th. So that's coming up. And then finally, today is National Name Yourself Day. It's a day when you can give yourself a different name. Now, that'd be fine if you just want to casually do it, right? Like, today, call me Dave. It's your morning buzz with Dave, not Richie. But if you want to make it a little bit more formal, today could also be the day that you could do it. There are many reasons why people change their names, things like marriage, divorce being the most common of reasons. Some people change their name because they want to hide from something. Although a legal name change can't be done to evade law enforcement or debt, some people just change their name to have a fresh start. Besides not being able to legally change one's name to evade law enforcement or paying bills, there are also other rules that have to be followed. In most circumstances, it's not permissible to change your name to a celebrity's name because that's seeming to be misleading. A name change can't be changed to like a numeral or a punctuation mark, although I would love to just change my name to exclamation mark. I feel like that would be fitting, but just simple, easy. The changing name process is varied from state to state. Each state has different rules and different costs. It can cost under $100 in some states in the United States to over $1,000 in other. A legal document such as a marriage certificate, divorce decree, or court-granted petition must first be obtained before you can change your name. After the legal document is obtained, then you have to submit to government agencies like the Social Security Administration, the Department of Motor Vehicles, and the Internal Revenue Service. Then the name change should be made aware to all institutions such as banks, credit card companies, and utility companies. Even the post office should also be notified. When I think about changing my name, it sort of feels exhausting. So be really sure that you're not just celebrating the holiday if you're going to go about changing your name. Be really sure before you do it, because I feel like probably changing it back to what you had is also a chore. Happy National Name Yourself Day. That is your morning buzz. Now, there are so many things that we can do on a daily basis that help us live more sustainable lifestyles. Sometimes we just don't know where to start. Well, Fedi Korbatov felt the same way, and it inspired him to start a new and innovative business from his college dorm. Fedi is the founder of an organization called Baba Bags, a reusable bag social enterprise. His company is doing all that it can to give back to the community and to help the planet. And he joins us today to speak about his adventures as an entrepreneur and college student and how we can live a more sustainable life. Welcome, Fedi.
Thanks for having me.
So I have to know where you get the name Baba Bags from.
Yeah, of course. So Baba means grandma in Ukrainian. I'm Ukrainian. My dad's side of the family, or my dad is born in Ukraine, and then my mom's parents were born in Ukraine. So basically the inspiration for the business happened where Baba means grandma in Ukrainian, and my Ukrainian grandmother came from Ukraine to the States, and she gave our family this reusable bag that actually looks very similar to what the Baba bags look like today. And our family started using them, and I really was fascinated by the bag just because of how compact it was. When I was going to the grocery store, I usually would forget my reusable bags because mm-hmm. they were big or bulky, but I could put it in my pocket. When my mom would go, she could put it in her purse. But then when going to, after checking out at the store, it could then stretch out and fit all of our groceries, which, usually we would need, 2-3 other reusable bags when we were using other bags. And so ultimately the light bulb moment came for the business when my mom came from the grocery store and she had like a huge smile on her face. And I was like, what happened, Mom? And she was like, geez, I got two compliments on our last grocery trip just off of the bag. And so seeing that, this emotion that my mom was, that this bag had given me, or given my mother, sorry. Mm-hmm. And just seeing just how practical it was, just kind of like all these little combinations just got me started thinking about how this could be a great solution to a problem that I have actually just been learning about, which was eliminating single-use plastic bag usage. And so, because currently about 100 billion plastic bags are used each year, mm-hmm. 1,500 plastic shopping bags are used by families each year. And the problem is that we only use these plastic bags for only, 14 minutes. If you think about it, you go to the grocery store, they pack up your stuff, you take it to your car, you drive from your car to your house, apartment, wherever you may live, and then you dispose it. So 14 minutes, and then the problem is that these plastic bags then last up to 500 years in our landfills, or even worse, our oceans, if they get into our oceans. So saw this as a great way to eliminate some single-use plastic bag usage, but also kind of incorporate my Ukrainian heritage that I had grown up with. So took the leap to start a business.
I have so many questions around this, so I hope you don't mind if I just sort of dance around with the questions. How does the bag work? The way that you describe it, I'm sort of envisioning this like magical Mary Poppins bag that you're able to pull a lamp out of, and you're saying you're able to put all of your groceries in. How does that work?
Yeah, so it's like a net bag, right? It's a net bag, and there's like net bags right now, like in the market. But what makes ours is a little bit different is that Ours are like handmade, so they just are able to carry much more weight. And I'd love to send you like a link afterwards, or people could actually go to our YouTube, which is Baba Bags. But in our like introduction video, mm-hmm. Our bags carry over 120 pounds. So what wow. gives? So yeah, that's why every bag comes with a lifetime warranty. Is that every bag, or they're just like very strong, so you can just kind of put as much as you need, or as much as you fit. You never have to worry about weight. It's more about how much you fit. But since it's like a net bag and it's made out of organic cotton, it's able to stretch out and just kind of really take the form and the shape of whatever you're putting in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that way it just like kind of is able to, yeah, just, I guess, just adapts to whatever you're putting into it and makes it flexible to put as much as you need, just because it can stretch out.
Well, I'm thinking about carrying 120 pounds of food out of a grocery store. That seems like a lot, but cool,
yeah.
But great to know that it could be able to do that. And then additionally, I think of the plastic bag use, you know, when you go and you get things like your gallons of milk or any sort of, juice, those kind of heavier items. Oftentimes you have to double or even triple bag those in the plastic bag, so you're eliminating even that further step. You gave that statistic of, you know, an average family, United States family, uses, I think you said, 1,500 bags, likely for only 14 minutes. I mean, to be able to even eliminate half of that would make a significant difference just in a singular household.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, one bag is never going to actually carry 120 pounds. Because no one's ever going to have to put that much in there.
Right.
But that just shows the quality of the bag. But then you're totally right. Items at the grocery store, yeah, like milk and stuff, need to be double or triple bagged, or are just double and triple bagged by the clerk at the counter. And those are just really easy ways to just eliminate the use of plastic bags, just because, yeah, it's just a very easy way. And, you know, we did an experiment actually this summer where because a lot of people were using like grocery pickup. So we ordered a Walmart grocery pickup. They used all plastic bags, and then we converted them into Baba bags. And so when we converted it, we did like a very, very big order. And we ended up having to use 3 Baja bags, just because we did like a week and a half's worth of, or honestly, like probably 2 weeks worth of groceries.
Mm-hmm.
And, it ended up that 3 bags replaced, what would be equivalent to, 4 plastic bags per bag. So that's 4, 8, 12. So, they used a total of 12 plastic bags, and we only needed to use 3. So yeah, one replaced 4 plastic bags. And a lot of it was because some of the bags had to be, you know, double plastic bagged, just because of heavier items.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Fedi Korbatov about his company, Baba Bags, which is essentially a reusable cotton-based net bag for when you go to the grocery store, or really, I guess, any store, so you don't have to use the plastic bags that are those single-use plastics. And there are a lot of stores across the country, different states, cities in particular that I can think of, that have said, we're not even using single plastic bags anymore in our grocery stores and in our outlets. You see this as a future move, and obviously an opportunity for you to be able to get into those communities more and more?
Yeah, of course. And so, yeah, COVID unfortunately had kind of stopped that process of trying to get into a lot of grocery stores, just because of safety. Grocery stores feel that a single use option right now during COVID is a better option. Mm-hmm. So we've honestly focused more of our attention at local farmer markets. So we are based in Chicago, and then also working on our e-commerce platform. But once, you know, everything gets back to normal, which hopefully I think that's in, you know, the next couple months, next 3-4 months, a lot of our focus is going to be to get into these grocery stores that were maybe a little bit more hesitant during COVID.
An aspect of what you're doing, people define as a social entrepreneur, meaning that you guys are conscious of social issues or of environmental issues. And you do a portion of that with giving back some of your profits to nonprofits. Can you talk about what you guys do there?
Yeah, sure. So we have two different color biobags right now. Our orange one is partnered with the National Pediatric Cancer Foundation. And our green one is partnered with Action Against Hunger. And so for every bag sold, $2 is donated to the respective or to the color that's partnered with that bag. So, yeah, if it was a green bag that was sold, then $2 is donated to Action Against Hunger. Same thing if an orange bag was sold to the Pediatric Cancer Foundation. I'm actually very excited. So we had a kind of March Madness social cause edition where we had 8 different causes, and we were posting it on our Instagram where causes would go head to head with each other, and you know, our followers, our customers, anyone who wanted to could vote for what our next cause would be. And so that little competition and campaign ended last week, and the winner is education. So our next bio bag will be something to do with education. We'll be partnered with an education nonprofit, and more info on that will probably be within the next 2 weeks, and we'll be able to launch that third color bag, which I'm very excited about.
What is it for you as an entrepreneur? I mean, dollars are precious. What is it about giving back to these nonprofits that's important to you as part of your business structure?
Right. So, I mean, it first is kind of at the very core of our idea or of the idea. So Baba means grandma, like I said. And so my grandma had always kind of instilled in me giving is important. You need to be, you know, not always taking, but also giving. And so that's why I like to say that Baba Bags likes to give the same grandmotherly love and attention to detail to our customers, our community, and our planet. I just honestly think that giving is good for business. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, when I wake up every day to work on something, I don't want it just to be, you know, just about the dollars. It has to be something more than that. And so I just really believe in our mission, which is eliminating single use plastic bag usage, but also giving back to impactful nonprofits. And that's a mission that gets me very excited every day. And it's worth making these connections with these nonprofits and trying to help them further their mission.
Now, where the light bulb went off after your mom had visited a grocery store and received so many compliments, I have to wonder, did you cut her in on the business as well?
Well, I asked her if she wanted to help me out or like be, I guess, a partner in it.
Uh-huh.
And she said, you know, she's kind of a little like informal board of directors. So like whenever I have an idea or like, you know, want to ask her or have like a question on something or, you know, have like maybe a new design for like a logo or for a bag. I definitely use her as a resource just to ask her some questions and get her opinion. Because she helped inspire that light bulb moment, and she's still plays a huge role in the business, but I guess has no formal title.
I'm willing to give her that title if you want, of CMO, the Chief Mothering Officer. I think that might put it on a business card and invite her in. Being an entrepreneur, a lot of people will be listening to this and saying, oh, man, that's the path that I want to go. Not necessarily that they want to make a Baba bag and try and eliminate single-use plastics, but they think, man, I've got an idea. I want to have the courage or the bravery to be able to step into that space or the hard work or the grit or whatever that the characteristic may be. What would be the one piece of advice that you would give someone who feels like they have an idea that could change the world or certainly change the marketplace but just haven't done it yet?
Honestly, I probably have two. I actually might have three. Just like, because I think in entrepreneurship, resources is just so important. So trying to give the resources that I wish I had before is pretty important. I feel like, so the first one is just kind of to look at if you're going to like college, look at like some, if your college has any entrepreneurship programs or like, for example, in your community, if your community has any entrepreneurship programs. So like right after I had that light bulb moment of Bob Eggs, I went back to the University of Oklahoma. That's where I was studying. And there was a thing called the Sooner Innovation Fund, where basically it was a program where I would get mentorship and they would help me with my like market research process and even help fund some of my market research. And so that program was very, very impactful for me, just because it gave me mentorship of, you know, I'm still young, didn't really know maybe how to navigate this market research process. And they really helped me with that and even helped me fund that. So look for like, you know, either competitions or programs at your local school, or your local community.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is also is to, if you really have an idea and you're really serious about pursuing it, is to sign up for a SCORE mentor. So that's S-C-O-R-E mentor. And so this is a program that's from the SBA, so the Small Business Association. And so basically you can sign up for a SCORE mentor for free, and you can kind of say what you need help with. So let's say maybe it's like executing a business, or maybe a business plan, or maybe you need more help with marketing, or whatever you it may be, you can kind of say what you need. And then a local mentor, so in this case, someone from Utah, would kind of connect with you, and then they would be your mentor, where you can kind of, you know, tell them your business problems or tell them where you're at in your business. Mm-hmm. And this experienced professional can then just honestly really help you organize your thoughts and help you execute your dream and your vision. And so, and then my third one is, I always like to say this one is, one of my favorite podcasts is How I Built This.
It's oh yeah. Yep.
Podcast. Oh, you're familiar with
yeah,
it? Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So honestly, that's been a huge influence in my entrepreneurial journey, of just kind of hearing how these, what, you know, I used to think that in entrepreneurship to create like influential brands like Lululemon.
Oh, are you still there, Fetty? We lost you. Oh, it sounds like we lost Fetty. Fetty Korbatov is the founder of Baba Bags, a reusable bag social enterprise that tries to give love and attention to every detail and to give back to the planet. A lot of great pieces of advice for even just the entrepreneur seeking to step out, but especially as we look to eliminate those single-use plastics. If you want to find out more about Fetty's work, you can hop online to baba-bags.com. Now, if you're looking for ways to, you know, look or at least feel like an experienced weightlifter on your first day at the gym, do not go anywhere, because we've got those tips and that great information for you as you begin weightlifting. Coming back, you're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Now, if you are an experienced weightlifter, likely what we're going to talk about is going to just reaffirm the things that you already know. But I want to speak to those people who are like, you know what? I really love cardio, but I need to move into lifting some weights. I need to be completely balanced. Or I have the same routine that I have constantly been doing every time I've gone to the gym for insert length amount of time, and they want to be able to change it up. Or maybe you're a little bit like me and you used to be really good about going to the gym, and then this little pandemic occurred and now you feel like you're just starting all over again. It may seem like weightlifting is just something that you're into or you're not, but is it possible to reach a level of fitness with just a little time and proper training, and something that you can bring into your life and get the benefits of? So how do we get started? Well, here today to give us all the tips and tricks is senior medical writer and personal trainer, Serkan Yaman. Welcome, Serkan.
Hello. Hi, Richie.
It's great to have you here on the show. I know when we're considering weightlifting or we're considering cardio, it seems to me that what I'm told most often is that it should be a combination of both.
Absolutely. So both weight training and cardio are very, very important forms of exercise. They do overlap. The benefits that each one provides do overlap, but then they do offer distinct benefits each as well. So, for example, weight training is fantastic for developing muscle and strength, for the gents. That's what the gents usually want to do.
Uh-huh.
And for the ladies usually want to develop shape and tone. But those aren't the only benefits for weight training. For example, using weight training, you can develop power and endurance and your agility as well as your speed. You can develop your balance and your coordination and your athleticism. You can improve your sporting performance. There are many benefits to be had from weight training.
Why do you suppose it's so intimidating when people are looking to get into weight training? Is it really as complex as maybe we created in our mind?
It really depends how seriously you want to take it. So someone who does bodybuilding, for example, they will take it much more seriously than an average gym goer. The average gym goer just has to go and follow a standard, well, I wouldn't say a standard weight training program,
mm-hmm.
but at least a decent weight training program that's been balanced and designed properly. Whereas a bodybuilder will try to take the extra mile, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. They will focus more excessively on the details of things, especially diet. Diet is incredibly important when it comes to bodybuilders, but not so much. Well, it is important for us as well, the average gym goer, but it's not as important as it is for the bodybuilder.
So if someone is listening to this, and as I sort of couched it in the beginning of this, they either have not done weight training for a while, or maybe they've never done it. What kind of instruction do you have for that person who's looking to make weight training a part of their gym routine?
So what I would definitely say is for someone to do well in weight training or to at least experience the benefits of weight training, they need just two things. The first thing is a training program, and you can find training programs on my website, by the way,
mm-hmm.
weighttraining.guide, and they're all for free, by the way. So all you need is a training program and you need a gym membership. Now, if you don't want to train in a gym, you can train at home as long as you've got the necessary equipment. Believe it or not, you can actually make do with a simple set of resistance bands. So resistance bands are just elastics mm-hmm. with clips on either end. And you can attach as many of these resistance bands onto those handles as you need, in order to either increase or decrease the amount of resistance. And then you can anchor those resistance bands to a door and pull up those resistance bands with the handles. And you usually get some ankle straps as well. So you can pull up the bands with your arms and your legs and literally do hundreds of exercises. But you can never get very far with just resistance bands. So I would always recommend that you invest in some decent gym equipment.
For the person who's just sort of onboarding or getting into it, is the best place to start resistance bands? Because if we try and lift, you know, too heavy or we get sort of overboard, that's where people will get hurt.
Absolutely. And that was going to be the key message today as well. I was going to tell you about the benefits of weight training. But the other key message was going to be that safety always comes first. Okay. And the thing is, resistance bands, I won't say that they're particularly safer. As long as you are careful when mm-hmm. you lift the weights, you should be okay. Resistance bands can be as dangerous, or not as dangerous, but dangerous, just like weights, if they snap, for example. As long as you follow safety rules, you should be okay.
The phrase that I'm often told about weight training or cardio as well is listen to your body. For people that may not actually know what that means or be able to interpret what it is that their body is saying, what does that even mean?
I mean, the body is a finely tuned, complex, complicated system. And it's got lots of feedback mechanisms that tell you if it's okay or not. And so if you're overtraining, for example, you could experience various symptoms. Now, overtraining is very rare. You know, athletes overtrain sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare for the average gym goer to overtrain. But listening to your body basically means if you can still feel soreness in your muscles, like serious soreness, then maybe don't train that day. Soreness is a good thing. It means that you've damaged some muscle tissue, but in a good way, in a way that the muscles will be able to repair it and will allow you to improve and to get bigger and to get stronger and to get fitter and to get healthier. But if you ever experience a sharp pain, now that is something to worry about. Sharp pains are dangerous. Soreness is not. Soreness means you've had a good workout.
Visiting with Serkan Yaman about weight training and getting us sort of into the conversation about doing it, whether it's something that we've done previously or just something that we recognize, oh, you know, maybe I don't have the body shape that I would like, or maybe I would like to change that up a little bit. Is there differences in weight training for an older person versus a younger person?
I would say there isn't, because we all have a human body, basically. Hmm. And what we're going to do, the mechanics of the actions that we're going to execute are basically the same for anyone and everyone. If you're older, I would say be careful. Everyone should be careful, of course. But if you're older, be a bit more careful. Make sure you warm up before your workouts, always. That's very, very important. And you should be okay. I don't see any big differences between being younger or older. I myself, I'm 43, and I mean, that's not particularly old, but I will be in the gym and I'll be doing the same things as the younger guys, if not bigger movements, heavier weights.
When you are at the gym or as you're working with clients, what do you see as the most common mistakes that someone that's getting into weight training do?
That is a fantastic question. And I wanted to speak about this one. Most guys go to the gym and they do not follow a training program. The same with ladies. They go there and they just do what they think is right or what they want to do. And that is not a good idea. A lot of guys go to the gym and they do not train their legs as much. Mm-hmm. They neglect their legs. So they end up with skinny legs and a muscular upper body, which isn't good. A lot of ladies go to the gym and they neglect their upper bodies, and that's not good either. The body is balanced, and we have to make sure that we do not ruin the balance. So, for example, if you look at the muscles that extend your elbow, they should be as strong as the muscles that flex your elbow. And a lot of guys go to the gym and they focus more on the muscles that flex their elbow because these are more visible in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And that's not good because they lose that balance.
So I want to pick up a question that is sort of curious to me as you were saying it, and I'm sure you'll be able to explain it. If we work out our upper body, say as gentlemen would typically do, and sort of neglect their lower body, I understand the concept that it would be out of balance. But does it affect us health wise, or is it just
it can
a look?
Be dangerous?
Yeah. Oh, so what are the dangers behind it?
Well, not necessarily dangerous regarding the upper body versus the lower body.
Okay.
But for example, if you go and you do more pushing exercises than you do pulling exercises, that's not good because the pushing exercises, for example, the bench press, where you lie down and you push a barbell upwards, that works your chest and the front parts of your shoulders and the back parts of your upper arms or your triceps. And if you do that more than you do pulling exercises, which are your back muscles, what happens is the front muscles pull on your shoulder joint and they pull your shoulders forward. Hmm. And in other words, it compromises your shoulder joint. And then you can end up with shoulder pain. And this is one of the biggest complaints in the gym from guys. They go to the gym, within 1 or 2 years, they start experiencing shoulder pain because they have not trained properly. They have not followed a balanced training program. They have done more pushing than pulling. And so this has compromised their shoulders. And so it's very, very important to always follow a balanced training program that understands the way the body works and the differences between the strengths of the different types of muscles.
You mentioned that it's a fool's errand to go to the gym without a training guide, a training plan. I know that you have some available and have given them as free for people to be able to check out, weighttraining.guide. I would be curious, how do we know that a plan is right for us?
The way that I've designed my training programs is to make sure that anyone can use them. I literally spent weeks programming and planning these training programs just to try to accommodate any kind of need or any kind of difficulty. And so the early training programs start people off very, very simply and easily and ease them into the different types of exercises and help them to move on to more difficult exercises. And so that's very, very important as well. A training program should start off light and gradually and easily and simply adjust and become increasingly difficult and challenging. And it's that challenge, that increase in the challenge, that helps to improve and grow and develop, if you know what I mean.
To where we started, if someone is looking to get into this, how much time should they be planning and how many times a week as they try and work this into their schedule? They've recognized the importance. They know that they can get a training guide from your website, and then they recognize the importance of it. But now as we look to actually make that time within our schedule, what is your recommendation on both frequency and duration?
So all you need to derive all the benefits of weight training, and there are many benefits, all you need is 4 hours per week, or even 3 hours per week. If you do it for 3 hours per week, if you have just three workouts per week, then there would have to be full body workouts where you're training your whole body. Now that can take maybe 1 hour, 20 minutes, but that would be just three workouts per week. If you do four workouts per week, then you can split your body into two pieces, and train one piece, let's just say your upper body and your lower body. And so one day you train your upper body, the next day you rest. No, actually, the next day you train your lower body, then the next day you rest, then the next day you train your upper body again, and then the next day you rest, and then you train your upper body. Did I mix that? I think I messed that up.
No. Just so you're able to, with the body divided, be able to hit it those 4 times a week if that's what you're doing. That seems doable. And something that, as you've expressed, the health benefits, whether it's balance or athleticism or, you know, shape or build, you know, all these things, great reasons for us to consider weight training. Our time with you has grown short. So I appreciate you being willing to come on to be able to tell us about what you are doing and the importance of weight training as we look to bring this into our life. We've been visiting with Serkan Yaman, who is a personal trainer, the founder of the weighttraining.guide and author of the ebook How to Create a Great Body, the second edition, which has just been published out there for Amazon Kindle. You can also find him on Instagram at Weight Training Guide. That's his handle there. If you ever have a suggestion, great things that you want to hear on The Lisa Show, be sure to send us an email, thelisashow@byu.edu. Put that topic suggestion or guest suggestion there in the subject line. Coming up, we're going to find out how COVID-19 has affected women in the workforce and what it is that we can do about it. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Hi, this is Lisa.
Hey, it's me, Richie T.
To do it. You know what's good for you?
A bunch of things that I can do for the weekend. Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Richie T. Do you have any long-forgotten collections lying around your house? You know, maybe things that people don't even know that you collect. Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to discuss what we personally have been accumulating over the years. And coming up in your morning buzz, imagine you were able to go a year in the past and be able to tell your year-ago self about the pandemic. What would it look like? What would you say? What warnings would you give? Well, one individual sort of did this. I'll tell you about it coming up in your morning buzz. As you might know, the pandemic created an artificial economic recession across the globe. As countries went into lockdown mode, many people lost their jobs, manufacturing shut down, and some/most economies just stopped. While millions were affected by this artificial recession, new studies show that women specifically have borne the brunt of the pandemic-related job changes. Many women lost their jobs or left the workplace to care for their children. Well, we wanted to know more about this and what these studies are telling us regarding COVID-19 and how it is, in fact, affecting working women. So joining us today is the director of the Utah Women in Leadership Project, Susan Madsen. Welcome back to The Lisa Show, Susan.
Great to be here.
Now, I have heard this this explained as the pink recession. Is that what you're calling it?
Yeah, sheesh session or pink recession, but I use the pink recession more. And really that means that women have left the workplace in droves or had considered it. And as I've said in some of my writings, although pink is often viewed as a pretty color, the pink recession is not necessarily pretty.
Why is this so much more on women than women and men equally?
Well, first of all, there's many reasons. But first of all, one of them is that, you know, women are really, when you look at the industries that they work in, they're in some of the industries that were really shut down early on and have struggled more to pick up, even though many of them have picked up during the pandemic, many of them are still struggling. Things like food services and hospitality you know, even in some of the educational roles and so forth. And as you know, most of the positions, the teaching positions in K-12 are women. And even though those didn't end, the struggle that educators have had in trying to figure out how to do online and back and forth, being live in classes and all of that has caused some real stress as well. But we really, in our recent report that focuses on Utah, really looked at reasons why women specifically left here in the state of Utah, but it aligns so much with the national data around the U.S.
So let's pick up some of those pieces. I would think that in some households, it needed to be decided that one person would come home to be able to care for kids. How come that sort of, not automatically, but more often than not, goes to women than men?
Well, if you happen to have two parents in the home, first of all, you know, we always have to keep in mind that some families with kids specifically have single parents, which,
right,
of course, took the brunt of a lot of this. But, you know, if there's two parents and they're both working, you know, more women did lose their jobs. I mean, when you look at the economic impact of COVID-19, you know, even early on from like February to May, you know, almost 12 million women lost their jobs, about 9 million men, but definitely more women. And I found one of the most interesting statistics is in the U.S., just in December, 140,000 people lost their jobs, and every one of them was women. And so when we look at why women left the workplace, the number one thing is that their employer was financially impacted. But then the secondary reason is really sometimes women were just stuck. It's like somebody has to take care of the kids, and I can't keep doing this job and trying to do homeschooling with my kids, and I don't have daycare for my 2 and 3 year old running around. And so sometimes they left totally, but we also saw, especially in our data and the U.S. data, that some just, you know, went from full-time to part-time. And on the other hand, we did find 12% of women in our sample who actually took on more responsibilities because their spouse maybe lost their job. So they had to pull in, you know, going from part-time to full-time or taking an additional job. So what a shift, lots of shifts. You know, it's not just totally losing jobs, but different kinds of shifts in the workplace. As you know, women just have, throughout time, have done way more unpaid care work than men, and that impacts many things.
Now, when we talk about the impacts of COVID-19, the pandemic on women, does it affect all women specifically, or equally, I guess I should say, or does it affect different minority groups or different subgroups differently?
That's a great question. First of all, it does definitely impact women of color. The research that has come out nationally, but also our research, even in the state of Utah, shows already that women of color have been impacted, especially Hispanic women. I mean, all women of color, but in the national research, Hispanic women have really taken the brunt of really worry, job loss, financially being worse off in 2020. Worried about paying bills and those things. And we did see that play out in the data that we have in the state of Utah as well. And to your other part of your question, women equally, you know, of course, the experiences of women and men who have children in the home versus, you know, people like me who I have four children, but they're not at my home anymore, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. my delightful grandchildren are not in the home, but I, you know, enjoy seeing them. And so even though I have been impacted significantly, not in the same ways, and not, I'll just have to say, you know, I don't have kids at home, like I said, and I really feel for all those mothers with kids at home. You know, it's great on one hand. They like having the kids around in one hand, but worrying about making sure they don't miss the learning for a full year with some of them that they would have gotten in school, we know that there's definitely an impact. So, Richie, one other thing is the research talks about is that women generally, even before the pandemic, take on more of what's called, I'm putting this in quote marks, emotional load. And that really is the worry. You know, we worry more than men. We worry about our kids. We worry about their safety. We worry, and sometimes the men don't worry as much, so we feel like we have to worry twice as much.
We're visiting with Susan Madsen, who is the director of Utah Women in Leadership, and you are talking about this emotional load. I want to go a little bit further. So, I mean, we're speaking in sort of generalized statements, but it seems that women sort of take on more of this emotional load. Why do you feel like that is? And then what are we doing to make sure that we don't overburden the women so that, you know, that they can't, I'm failing at words for what I want to say, but that they become overwhelmed and then can't be able to function.
Yeah, that's a great question. So what we know is before the pandemic, everything that was kind of unequal to begin with is more unequal. Mm. Everything that is has really been, you know, the struggles are more struggles. And so unpaid care work is one of the things, and sometimes it's called, I'm putting quote marks up, the second shift. Mm-hmm. So even if men and women work, you know, the same hours, women tend to do significantly more than men in terms of unpaid care work. And the interest in that can housework and kids and elder care and all of that stuff kind of comes in. What's really interesting, though, is, and I have to put this out there, that most men have stepped up in a lot of ways during the pandemic to pick up more as well. However, even with that, what I find is interesting is the research that has come in, not my own, but some other research, says that men are perceiving that they're working pretty equally on this unpaid care work during the pandemic than women. And when you look at women's perceptions, no. No, that's not the case. In terms of why, it's part of its socialization. I mean, it's the way that we've seen it done. It's the way that our mothers did it. It's the way that we see relationships in society. There's that. And also, when you look, I have to just say it, when you look at how we're made, women are made differently than men. Mm-hmm. Our brains are more similar than different, but there's still some evidence to show that we have kind of this worry place, you know, the estrogen that comes in and stuff. So we do worry, and it's a good thing we worry. Throughout my years, I've, you know, when I see kids with their dads sometimes, so they're wandering in and out of cars, and I'm like, this is why we have women to keep our children alive. So that worry, though, can be a drain, and we measured in this study we just released burnout.
So I would be curious then to ask a little bit about that. If men perceive that they're balanced, and women are like, no, that's not what this is. How can you possibly see that? But if the changes then would need to be coming from the men to be able to make it more balanced, how do we make a change speaking in sort of general terms, if men don't see that it is unbalanced, how do you navigate a space for a change to even begin to occur?
Well, that's interesting because oftentimes, I mean, it comes on the shoulders of both women and men. So in terms of women, oftentimes we just don't even talk about this. We just keep doing what we do. Or sometimes we have high standards, like cleaning the bathroom. Let's just talk about that. Like, okay, my husband's supposed to be cleaning the bathroom. Oh, it's not quite right. Okay, I'm going to have to go in and clean it after. So sometimes we have this, women tend to be more perfectionistic than men. So sometimes it comes to that. But sometimes we just need to have really good conversations. And there's some great evidence in the, quote, partnership literature. And some of our psychologists and therapists in the state of Utah and beyond talk about this, that actually there's some tools that, couples can use to say, let's list all the things that we do and who does this or that, to be actually to be more transparent in what we do. A lot of people, most people in relationships do not have these conversations. I think as we move forward, they're going to be more important. And some say, hey, before you even get married, you should be having these conversations.
Sure.
To lay it out. So those are a couple of ideas.
Yeah, I know anecdotally and from what I observe, like on social media and from visiting with friends, where if it is the woman who has stayed in the workplace and the man has sort of transitioned to home, whether because the money that was being made more by the woman or for whatever reason, right? The family decided, when there's that recognition of, oh, this is what my partner does.
Yes.
I had no idea. You know, a kudos and appreciation that you know, maybe hadn't been seen before the pandemic. So in the remainder of the time that we have with you, visiting with Susan Madsen, who is the director of the Utah Women and Leadership Project, I would be curious as to what you, if you can listen or look into your post-pandemic crystal ball, are we going to see things return back to normal? Will there be a greater sensitivity for what occurs in the home, and men and women will balance that out as they return to work? Or what do you see for women moving forward?
Well, I don't think, when, you know, I do a lot for women in business settings and so forth. I do not see us moving 100% back. I do see us shifting somewhat back, but companies now and organizations, so I should use the word organization. So it's not just companies, but mm-hmm. people work all in business, in government and universities and so forth. They have had to, organizations have had to shift now to do increased flexibility, of course, in work location and working hours and other benefits, like different kinds of leave benefits and different things. So even though many organizations had some of these things, not more organizations have been shifted, almost forced, right?
Mm-hmm.
Forced into doing that. And I think that because we've raised our expectations as a society that companies can do that, and we're moving into companies should do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think companies are going to be able to pull back on all of these things, especially telecommuting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because actually it can be done now. You can do things that way. So people aren't just going to shift back and go 5 days a week. But 20 years ago, I did dissertation research on this and found that actually 2 to 3 days working at home, you could be more productive, but it's good to go into the office some. So I see a shift with that. In terms of the home and in society, absolutely. I think more men who have had the luxury, like I said, not everybody had the luxury to do remote work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That they see, my own husband, he never worked at home, and now he's like, I don't see working in the workplace. But I think, you know, there's just more things that men have started to pick up in terms of responsibility, in terms of being around the kids more and picking up some. So I do think, you know, having these conversations more, and even if a woman works part-time, it's still important to have these conversations about shared partnership. I think there's great tools out there. For society, I think that's not going back either. I know in the state of Utah, I'm working with the new governor and the lieutenant governor and the administration on, let's change things. Let's have some public policies. I think other states would be the same as well. So I think this last year has shifted all of us into a place that we're going to be thinking more deeply about how we can be more equitable, right? And mm-hmm. and just do things that really that everybody can thrive more, not just certain people in the population. And always remembering in my work, the women of color and their experiences that are somewhat different than white women out there.
At the tail end of your research, you know, you've just released these findings with women through the pandemic, and we're able to study, as I understand it, thousands of women in their situation. Was there anything that surprised you within this research that in this last couple minutes that we have with you that you want to mention?
Well, I think the only other thing I would mention, and it wasn't a surprise, but it always makes me kind of sad, is that, you know, a little bit, almost 10% of the people that responded did say that they have been and are worried about violence in the home. Mm. And we know across in the state of Utah, 1 in 3 women will experience domestic violence. We know it's a little bit higher, but it's than other states, but it's a problem all over the country. And even though, you know, you might say it's only 10%, that's reality. I mean, that's like people's lives.
Yeah.
And when women are struggling with domestic violence in their home, and domestic violence impacts our kids, and they're called adverse childhood experiences. And what we know is when our kids are around that for the rest of their lives, they can be negatively impacted. They're more likely to be on drugs, commit crimes, and so forth. So that would be kind of the somber piece that I would say we've got to all learn more about domestic violence so we can spot that and be more helpful to ourselves if we suffer, you know, come across that, or help other people as well. I think this research is just very valuable for anybody to read.
If people want to find out more about the research that you've done, be able to read through it or even be able to see what you are doing next, where can they go to follow your latest?
So the Utah Women in Leadership Project website is utwomen.org, and we have a monthly newsletter, and we have people actually from all over the world that sign up because we have great research and resources and events that we have one today on male allyship, how men can better advance women. So love to have people join us at utwomen.org.
Dr. Susan Madsen is a professor of leadership at Utah State University and the director of the Utah Women and Leadership Project. Thank you again for being on the show with us.
Thanks so much.
Now, coming up, we're going to tell you about some things that we've been collecting. Do you have those odd collections hidden in the nooks and crannies of your home? Well, we're going to share what we've been collecting. And imagine being able to go back pre-pandemic and give yourself advice. Well, one person was able to do that, he said, ? I'll tell you about it coming back in your Morning Buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Are you settling in for a weekend by yourself? Maybe you don't have plans and you're looking to put something down on the calendar. Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to tell you about the best new streaming shows that will keep you company this weekend. But first, it's time for your Morning Buzz. Three things that I have collected. Speaking of collections, which we'll be talking about coming up, put together and now present for you to know about what's going on in this great country. An employee reportedly shot and killed one person while injuring multiple people at a business in Bryan, Texas, yesterday afternoon. Police say that the suspect is now in custody and the suspect used a handgun. This was at the Kent Moore Cabinets Warehouse in Bryan, Texas. An early morning tweet this morning from the royal family. It says, "It is with deep sorrow that Her Majesty the Queen has announced the death of her beloved husband." That's right, the Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. His Royal Highness passed away early this morning at Windsor Castle. He was 99 years old. They say that he died with complications around an infection that has occurred. So more as that sort of develops. But they had been married for, I think that I heard it was 74 years that they'd been married. So that message from Her Royal Highness this morning. And then also, I want you to imagine, this is trending over on YouTube, one of my favorite YouTube influencers, Julie Nolka. Imagine that you're able to travel back in the past. You know, that pre-pandemic you, that innocent you, that you that didn't know about all, you know, the turmoil, all the different things that would happen in the last year. What would you say to that person? Now, she's obviously not able to do it. It's tricks of the camera. But I enjoyed every bit of advice that Julie Nolka said to her year-ago self. It's trending in a video over on YouTube. It's called Explaining the Pandemic to My Past Self 1 Year Later. And that is your morning buzz. Lisa, I am embarrassed that we have known each other for this long and that I don't know the answer to the question that I'm about to ask you.
Uh-oh, what?
I feel like we should have been past this part of our relationship already. And quite frankly, I owe you an apology. So I want you to know I am sorry that I have not asked you this question previously. What do you collect? Do you collect anything? Do you have odd, weird collections or things that... Now, here's what doesn't count.
Okay.
So if you have like a lot of movies, but you haven't sought to have a collection, that doesn't count.
Yeah.
If you have a lot of music, but there's not some, you know, prescription to your music collection, that doesn't count.
All right.
If you, you know, whatever, kids, you could say you technically collect kids, but you just had them and raised
them. Can I say I collect memories?
Yeah. No.
No. Okay.
No. All of those things are not allowed.
All right.
Do you have and harbor and nurture any sort of collections?
Okay. So first of all, the things that I have a lot of that I don't get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
I have some of those.
Yeah. But clothes.
I like clothes.
Outfits.
No. The things that I really collect, I collect books.
Okay.
So.
Now tell me about your book collection then.
Yeah. So I have a lot of books, but then I collect certain ones. What can I say?
Historical?
Yeah. Historical books. I look for books on different topics and.
What are you not telling me about your book collection?
Well, here's the thing.
Is it specific colors of books? Because that's perfectly fine.
No, I organize them by color because I'm not a farmer.
Because I know that that's a huge trend right now.
Yeah. Well, no. I'm hesitant because I don't collect rare books. So I don't feel like I'm doing it right, but I'm still doing it my way.
Okay.
So I don't collect books that are valuable, that have any value other than I want these books in my home.
Okay.
So like classic literature,
parts
of the canon, some Shakespeare books and stuff like that. Like it's in my categories that are only significant to me.
Okay, but you
collect them. Like I do when I go to secondhand stores or when I go to, you know, I'm always looking for those.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's my first. And I've started a new collection recently in the last
spoons.
Year.
Spoons. Are you an old enough lady that you can start collecting spoons?
No, because I can't have anything that's like cluttery. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Is that a thing anymore, by the way, just putting a bookmark before you tell me what it is?
I don't know anyone who collects
because
spoons.
I love, like, every grandparent's house who you walk in and they have the spoon from every state.
Yeah,
and when I travel to, like, the gas stations when I do road trips, and they still sell
them.
Sterling Silver
but
Nevada
I don't know
spoon.
One person who does.
Okay, so now.
So anyway, so it's not that.
I built the anticipation. What is this?
Well, starting in the pandemic, I needed a project, and my good friend Casey, who's been a friend on the show, introduced me to collect. I mean, this is an old idea, but to this process of collecting albums.
Okay.
So
like vinyl.
Vinyl.
Okay.
And because I needed a project to busy my mind out of the sad thoughts, and so I am collecting an album from every year that I've been alive. So it's been fun because I research, you know, albums and when they came out. Because, you know, usually you know about when they came out, but not the actual
Thriller, 1983.
Year. Yeah.
Sure.
And so I'll research it and then I have a list of criteria. I'll organize it, make lists. Do you see why I do it?
I
can make a list. I can have a system for it. I can go to, you know, and daydream about which album, and I have to decide, and then I buy it, and then I can display it in a little thing so it's not cluttery, and then I can listen to it. So it fulfills a lot of great things that you need to sort of be a comfort in a time of stress. And so it's been this new hobby for me to collect albums. I'm really into it now.
So what I would be curious about, I mean, essentially you have limited the number of your collection.
Yeah.
32, one for every year that you've been alive.
You.
You're welcome. So say, for example, 83, right? I threw out Michael Jackson's Thriller. Mm-hmm. That would be like the most pivotal maybe album of that year, arguably. What with it being the highest grossing sales, et cetera. Is that sort of the quantification of what it is? Or is it the personal experience which you've had of that album of that particular year?
Interesting that you should ask, because it has changed. So at first I thought, I'm going to get like the iconic album that year so that I have a really great collection and, you know, variety, right? And then I start researching it, and then it turns out that because I am a music lover of lots of different genres, there's so many albums that were like so awesome that are personally meaningful to me. So it has expanded. I also kind of like it because I have the system, and you know I'm a rule follower. And it's like I'm breaking my own rules, which makes me feel like a rebel.
Yeah,
safe way.
Yeah, you are. Yes, you are.
So I break my own rules, and I don't even care.
Whoa. What, are you going to keep me in my own box that I've given myself? That's funny.
Exactly. And so it is completely ridiculous, and it is a hobby that and a collection that I've leaned into because of all of those reasons. Personal experience trumps everything. So if I'm like, I remember running around as a kid to this album and thinking this was so awesome, you know, Lionel Richie, then guess what? I have to have it.
What a great album that is, by the
way. Or this album I got as a tip for my paper route one Christmas.
Oh, really?
Thriller.
Oh,
so I have to have it.
Sure.
You know, like, so if I have a personal experience with the album, then it trumps any other rule. And now I'm just kind of like buying records that I like. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
Things are getting crazy.
Cool.
With my collection.
And
I love it.
You mentioned the Lionel Richie album. Can I tell you a quick story?
Always.
I've always been a hopeless romantic. And I remember I was in sixth grade and the girl's name was Lacey and I had the biggest crush ever. And we had in my mom's room, we had the record player.
Yeah.
And she had the old Lionel Richie album that has Hello, Is It Me? Or, you know, that song.
So great.
And I remember I was like, I know how I'm going to tell Lacey that I like her, right? And I'm sure back in my sixth grade vocabulary that I love her.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get her phone number.
No.
And then I'm going to call up and make sure that it's her. And then I'm going to hold the phone to the speaker and let her hear. Because the lyrics, if she can
say it all,
if she can hear the lyrics like how I've heard the lyrics.
That's amazing.
It's destiny. So I very sneakily got her telephone number one day at school, and I said, all right, okay, here, today's the day.
Oh,
I'm going to call
word.
Her up. Call the number, beep, beep, boop, boop, you know. Back then it was rotary, right? No. It wasn't really, but. And then I remember, okay, and I hear hello right from the other end of the phone, and I'm like, that sounds like her.
Oh, no.
And I stick the phone up to the speaker and,
hello.
Is it me you're looking for? Because I wonder where you are. It made me, I was also, in addition to being a romantic kid, I was also an emotional wreck of a teen. So, like, I would hear songs like that and just be like, bah! So, I get through, I don't know, a verse chorus of, you know, hello. And then I pick back up the phone because I can't just,
there in has to mind, be something she's that's gonna be like, this is what I've wanted to hear. I've been waiting for this. I feel the same way.
And I say, hello. And I hear on the other end, who is this? And I'm like, is this Lacey? Lacey had a twin sister named Polly, and that's who got the opportunity to hear my love declaration
through a
Lionel Richie playing the vinyl through the speaker.
See, you would have to, if you were collecting records,
I would have to have that album.
To have that album, even if some other album had higher gross sales that year.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
And in a defining moment that shaped most of my teen years,
I'm almost afraid to ask.
Polly said, "She doesn't like you. Don't call back." And hung up the phone. And I was like, okay.
Oh, poor Ricky.
Yeah, poor. Well, at this point, I was Rick.
Oh, you
I
were Rick, Rick, not was, Ricky. Nah, sorry.
I'm not
it's
Ricky.
It's hard to keep track.
I'm not Ricky in sixth grade, please.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Rick. I'm very serious to be taken, Rick. I wish I would have known what that meant back when I played that Lionel Richie album. It could have saved me a lot of heartache and a lot of record playing in my middle school years.
Yeah,
but that,
yeah,
that would definitely be an album that I would have to get.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny that, you know, this story comes up because that's what's so fun about collecting these albums that I didn't realize. So, like, I'm looking for different records, like they're like little slices of my life, and but they're good memories, so I love it. So I'm looking for a couple of albums that I don't have that I want to buy local. That's kind of fun of the that's
sure.
part of the
it's
fun
part of the
instead
hunt.
Of just, you know, ordering it from wherever. And it reminds me of like when I first got my driver's license and driving around. I want to find From Ohio by Firehose and, you know, Fly in the Flannel and, you know, all of those, you know, sort of early 90s that you're laughing.
No,
but,
I'm not. No.
Oh, these albums, just listening to them just remind
with
me.
You. Yeah. Yeah.
Of, you know, showing up at the concert, you know, seeing Firehose at the Ranch Bowl in Omaha, Nebraska.
Sure,
and.
Sure.
You know, wearing my Doc Martens and just like living my best life, just feeling that freedom. I don't know, just of every possibility. When I listen to the album, it sounds like that. It takes me back to sort of that time. I can, you know, enjoy it for just a minute, and I like it.
Well, I appreciate you being open and vulnerable enough to take us to that next level of our friendship, which is
my collections.
Do you have a collection? And if so, what is it? Next up, we're going to tell you about all the new streaming shows that you're going to have to make time for this weekend. Yeah, you don't have a choice. Have to make time. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
I'm always excited to see what pops up on my streaming services because I know there's a treat waiting for me.
Uh-huh.
It's
if
like
you
I,
liked.
I know. I don't like surprises generally. Hmm. Like they make me anxious and they can go horribly wrong. But if I know what kind of surprise it is, like it's a food surprise or it's a show surprise or a clothes surprise, then I know I'm going to like it. And so then it eases my anxiety. And then I can fully enjoy the surprise.
So with something that is being streamed into the Clark household, I would be curious. If I said, Lisa, you should really, I bet you would really like, will you go to said streaming service and just check it out?
Yeah.
Or
I
are you find it in your streaming service, see what like a Rotten Tomatoes if it's a movie.
Yeah.
You'll read the description and be like, I'm not. Why did Richie think I should watch this? Are you a read more or are you a take the recommendation and just go for it?
It depends on who it is.
So not me.
No, I'm not saying that. But if it's somebody that we have the same taste and they say you have to watch this, then I just do it. No questions asked.
Okay.
If I'm flipping through like many people do, you know, there's all these memes and videos about how, well, I just spent 2 hours, you know, the time it would take to watch an entire movie looking for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of relate to that sometimes on the weekend because I spend so much time watching trailers, reading reviews. I do look at Rotten Tomatoes, and if it's, you know, less than 80%, then I'm going to have to really think about it, that kind of stuff.
Okay. So
I do overthink.
So
yes.
Whether you just go sight unseen into your recommendations or you want something to look into and research more, we have for you some great things that are streaming this weekend. Let us start, as we always do, with Netflix.
Thunder Force is a new Netflix original superhero movie starring Melissa McCarthy and Octavia Spencer. I'm really excited about this because they're both really great.
Uh-huh.
So I almost don't even want to watch a review. I'm just going to do it sight unseen.
Just go for it. All right. How about Two Distant Strangers? This is an Oscar-nominated short film about a man reliving the same day where he's being hunted by a police officer. So it's sort of like Groundhog Day meets The Fugitive.
I was gonna say.
Just want to throw that out there.
Also, The Stand-In is a comedy about an actress who hires a lookalike to take her place while she's in rehab, featuring Drew Barrymore.
I don't recommend you try that at home. Diana, the interview that shook the world, is another thing streaming over on Netflix. It is a documentary, and it talks about Princess Diana's famous interviews.
Over on Hulu, we've got Everything's Going to Be Okay, Season 2. Or I should say, Gonna. It's gonna. It's a television comedy about a family that comes together through grief and the messiness of life.
Also, Stars fell on Alabama. I hope Alabama's okay. I wonder if that hurt. A newly released romance about a Hollywood star who helps her agent by pretending to be his girlfriend at his high school reunion.
I hope they don't fall in love.
I hope there's a montage.
And Deserto?
Sure. Desierto.
A thriller drama about a group of 13 trying to cross the Mexican-U.S. border.
How about over on Amazon Prime, we've got G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Is that the cartoon?
No, I don't think so. I think this is the live-action movie. But now you know, and as they say, knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe.
I always knew I can, if there's a jingle... On the waiting on the other end of a jingle, it's Lisa Valentine Clark.
That's me with jazz hands. Also on Disney Plus, Man of the House, it's Chevy Chase playing an attorney who's trying to win over the son of his serious girlfriend, the son being played by 90s sensation Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
Now, is this funny Chevy Chase or is this post-funny Chevy?
I don't know.
Because there is a definite time. I'd watch it. I love a Chevy Chase.
I was going to say, would you do it?
Is Fletch available on streaming? I'd watch that this weekend. You want to try something? As Lisa will tell you, oftentimes the weekend is more time to make food time.
Yeah.
So we like to give you some recommendations. I love this first one.
Okay.
Kahlua pork sliders with pineapple ginger drizzle from Valerie Bertinelli. You can check out that recipe there.
Also, those looking to make a big brunch, you can check out Sunny Anderson's French toast with caramelized pecans, strawberries, and cream. Tell you, if you've never had like a roasted strawberry, like caramelized strawberries, it'll change your strawberry game. Let me tell you, I'm not kidding. I'm a fan.
Yep. I never thought that I would hear the phrase, change your strawberry game. but I'm willing to do that.
A few select people know what I'm talking about, and those are my people.
Sonny Anderson's French toast. Okay. How about Guy Fieri's Slam-a-Jamma Parmigiana?
What? Say that again. I don't know if I heard you
Guy
correctly.
Guy Fieri's Slam-a-Jamma Parmigiana. Parmigiana.
You want to say Parmigiana?
Yeah, Parmigiana.
Parmigiana.
Listen, if it's even...
Slam-a-Jamma Parmigiana.
If it's even half as delicious as it is fun to say, I'm doing it this weekend.
Will you try it?
I like a Slam-a-Jamma Parmigiana. You have to slur it a little bit.
I want to eat it now.
Listen.
Guy Fieri, it's on.
There isn't anything that we recommend that I don't go, I'd eat that. You know, every single thing I'm always like, yeah, do I have enough time? I'd eat that.
For a nice savory snack or a side dish, you can check out Parmesan Pesto Zucchini Sticks from Ina Garten.
Or is it in a garden?
Okay.
I love
it's
food.
You can tell it's the weekend because we're bringing out the food puns.
How about podcasts? We always give you great recommendations of podcasts. Normally, I tell you a jolly story about this show. Let me just recommend The Lisa Show. Find and subscribe to it, won't you please?
And maybe this is the weekend where you share it with a friend on social media.
Yes.
You go, listen, I listened to this segment. This was my favorite. And you post it. That would be really great. We would appreciate that.
I'm going to level that up and say, I triple dog dare you.
You could also listen to Inside the Oscars. It's a look inside the nominations and fashion trends, because you can't have one without the other, that we'll be seeing in a few weeks at this year's Oscars.
Another one is A Journey to Launch. I was excited because when I first glanced at this recommendation, I thought it said A Journey to Lunch. And I was like, yeah, take me on the journey to lunch. But also equally as good, A Journey to Launch. This is a guide to reaching financial freedom.
Oh, okay. If you are looking to get out and do something in real life, IRL, as the kids say, there are certain things coming across the country. For the first time ever, the San Antonio Book Festival will be virtual and will be going all weekend long. So whether you're in Texas or not, you can still enjoy all of those festivities. That's something different.
Here's a hot take for you. Take your laptop or your reader device.
Mm-hmm.
Take a hotspot with you. Go sit in the shade of the park and participate in the San Antonio Book Festival online. How about that?
Pro tip. I like it.
Get yourself a hammock. A hammock?
What?
A hammock.
Why are you saying it?
I'm just making sure I pronounce it the way that anyone in this country would say it.
Cool.
Cross country. A hammock and sit and watch the San Antonio Book Festival. How about if you're feeling stressed? I'm going to need you to just take a moment. Mm. And we're going to change our mood. Maybe you're thinking about Gentle Yoga for Terrible Times. What a name. Gentle Yoga for Terrible Times. We're going to breathe in through the terrible times.
It's acknowledging what's happening.
And breathe out through the terrible times. That's happening tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
For those in South Carolina, you can check out the 3rd annual Taco Crawl, where you can try the best tacos in Columbia.
I actually have to catch a plane. I'm going. I didn't know I was doing this. I'm going to the 3rd annual Taco Crawl. Also, tomorrow is National Sibling Day. Get ready. Get those embarrassing photos of your family.
Oh, yeah.
Your siblings. Get ready to post those up on social media, or you can recreate them. I always like that, especially the younger kids are.
They never get old, do they?
No.
Where you're trying to do, like, not only the body movement, but the expression on the face and even the clothing. To me, those are so delightful.
If you're not at a point where you're going out with siblings, right? Maybe you're not socially to that point yet. Send them some money on Venmo and say, buy yourself lunch.
Oh,
I'd do it if we were together, but we're not.
That's a good idea.
National
That'd
Sibling
be a
Day.
Nice surprise. If you're looking for a good book to read, what's new on the New York Times bestseller list, you ask? Well, why don't you try Eternal by Lisa Scottoline. Three people involved in a love triangle find everything that they hold dear tested as Mussolini's power grows and laws change in Rome.
How about The Consequences of Fear? The Consequences of Fear.
I wish we had music when we announce these.
This is Jacqueline Winspear's 16th book in the Maisie Dobbs series. I'm not sure if Maisie talks like that.
She does.
But I really want her to.
I know.
I love that about books because I can put accents or like different things to the different characters. It's always a little bit like thwarting when I see that book turned into a movie and I go, that's not what I pictured Maisie Dobbs to be.
Yeah.
let us get back to The Consequences of Fear. As Nazi occupation increases, Maisie looks into a possible murder that might affect Britain's war efforts.
Also, The Bounty by Janet Ivanovich and Steve Hamilton. The 7th book in the Fox and O'Hare series, Kate and Nick seek help from their fathers as they go after a shadowy international organization in search of a lost train full of Nazi gold.
So with all of those great recommendations, whether it's something that we're streaming or something that we're going to read or something that we're cooking in the kitchen, the question then remains for you, Lisa Valentine Clark. Mm. What is it that you are doing this very weekend?
I'm going to cook something good.
Okay. Well, and then, you always do that.
Well, yeah, thanks. I think I always want to.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's funny because now I've slowly started to see the weekend in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly.
It's new food day.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And it's time for me to have a little bit more focus to work on some of the hobbies that I have have started to lean into thanks
like
to quarantine.
Like the canvas that's in your
room? Yeah, yeah. Like I have.
I've been
drawing more and I've been practicing my piano.
Yeah.
Two skills that I'm completely mediocre at and I'm giving in to the mediocrity of it. Like I like that about the whole situation. Like I'm not trying to make money off of it. I'm not trying to like do it in a performative aspect. I do it just because I love the practice of it and I get so much out of it. And it's just and so that's what I look forward to in the weekend now.
Will you, if I brought a keyboard into the studio here, would you come play scales or something for me?
That seems weird. That seems like a weird thing.
It is a little weird, but there's nothing that lets my mind sort of release than just like the tinkering of the piano in the background.
I'll tell you, there is something really soothing about it. I agree. I mean, if I can be a little tender about this moment, like my husband used to play beautifully. He has, you know, since passed. It's been a while, and I found myself missing that, right? Because he lost the use of his arms, you know. And he wasn't playing the piano in our home like he had been. I missed it so much. And for a while, I mourned that. I mean, I still probably always will. But then there was something that snapped in my brain. I'm being totally serious about it. Like, you used to play the piano. You can still, like, what, you know, you don't get everything you want in life, right? But you have control over some things. And I thought, you can have live piano music in your home again if you really want to. I talk to myself very tough love. I'm very stern with myself in my head. And so it was kind of like, if this is really an important thing to you and you want to do it, then sit down and play. You dummy. I'm sometimes a little mean to myself.
Yeah, sure.
It's fine.
Self-love.
I'm working on it.
Coming up on the Lisa show.
So I started playing. It doesn't sound really great, but it doesn't matter because I got that kind of back. I'm getting better. You know, you sort of improve little by little. And that gives you kind of a boost. You have live music in your home. It's what I wanted. So I actually found a little bit more encouragement from doing that than I thought.
Cool.
Yeah, it's just weird.
Is there a particular piece that you're working on for the weekend?
I work on several pieces at the same time. So a little Chopin piece.
Oh, really?
It's super hard. I need to... My taste is better than my talent. I'm very aware of that gulf right now.
Yeah. So you're doing a little Chopin. I don't know if you knew this or not, but my weekends I have spent writing piano music, and I have gone under the ghost name of Chopin. Two P's.
Cool.
Two P's. So no one ever gets stupid music joke. Thank you, everyone.
I love it. That was really great. I appreciate it.
Thank you for walking with me.
Thank you.
So I have to tell you, I'm pretty excited about my weekend because I have tricked my family.
Oh, this is great. What?
So my dad recently retired. He retired at the end of last year.
Okay.
Which means he's got lots of time. Lots of time. He's taking care of his mom. And he's also doing some other things with time. He's traveling a little bit. But I realized that this is the time for my dad to finally give back. Now, sure, he raised me. Sure. You know, he set me on a correct course and all the things. But where has he been lately, right?
What has
he done for me recently? So I called him up the other day and I said, Dad. He said, Son, how are you? He always says that to me. My favorite son, how are you? And I say, Dad, you say that to everyone. I said, Dad, what do you think maybe you and, you know, my stepmom, What do you think? You guys come over maybe late in the afternoon. I'll make something on the smoker, and we could have you guys over for dinner. And he says, Son, that sounds great. We haven't seen you for a while. They're now vaccinated. We're safe. They can be with us. All those things, right? So he said, that's great. And I said, how about you get here about 3 o'clock, and when you get here, I'm going to go ahead and throw the meat on the smoker, and we'll get it a nice slow and smoke. And he says, well, we don't normally eat dinner until, you know, 6 o'clock. And I said, Dad, who are you fooling? You're retired. You eat at 4:30. But I left that, you know, aside. And he said, what are we doing until then? And I said, Dad, I have the greatest opportunity. You and I can work alongside each other in my yard. Doesn't that sound fun? Like a project?
Man.
As we're coming out of the winter months and into the spring.
Did he see it coming?
Doesn't that sound fun? We'll get you a new pair of work gloves, Dad, because that's what he always used to try and get me to help in the yard. I got you a new pair of work gloves, son.
Funny.
Got you. So we'll make sure we know where all the utensils are, Dad. You know, the yard utensils. And we'll make sure we get you a nice new pair of gloves. And tell you what, Dad. And he said, what? I said, I'll even spring for one of those foam gardening pads that you would never let us have when we were kids. There was one in the house, and Dad always got it. I said, tell you what, I'll even get you both a foam pad for the gardening. And he gets to the end of the phone call. He says, Son, I'm really lucky to to have a son that cares for me so much, yeah. who just really knows, you know, he really knows what I want to do with my retirement time. So thank you. Thank you for offering me this gift. And we get done, you know, I tell him I love him, and we hang up on the phone, and I go, he might have been sarcastic at the end of that.
Wait, I'm starting to think that maybe he didn't mean that.
He'll be there. He'll be there to eat.
What a good guy. What a good guy.
I'm not sure that he means it. So that's part of this weekend.
That's
and I'm sure we'll eat some things. And
but you better like deliver
of course,
on your promise.
Of course. Of course. Of course.
Or else next time he won't believe you.
I think we're doing pork butt.
Oh yeah,
yeah. A long running pork butt, so it'll be nice and tender, melt in your mouth. Maybe I'll bring you some on Monday, so you can have some nachos, some pork nachos.
That's so
Does that sound
good.
Okay?
Yeah.
Pass that around with your family.
Yes, please.
Well, then I'm not doing it. This is just for you. If you're going to share with your family, forget it. This pork is for you.
Thanks.
You deserve it. You.
Two kinds of cheese.
Yeah.
That's the kind of nacho.
Listen, whatever
I'm
you do
about.
With the pork is up to you. I'm just bringing you the pork, but I will do that for you.
Aw, thanks. The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on our BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. You can also find us on Sirius XM channel 143.
I've told you before, and I will continue to tell you that you should find The Lisa Show wherever you find podcasts. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Do not miss a single moment.
On Monday's show, they say communication is essential to any relationship. What if you're bad at it? Well, don't worry. On Monday, we're going to help you establish better communication patterns.
Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.